writer Colin Fleming. His newest book, available everywhere, is titled If You, brackets, Fabula, Fantasy, Effery, Hope. You can also check out Colin's recent book on the 1951 film Scrooge, looking at it through a different lens than most would do. Colin, welcome in.
And Sam Cooke, too. The hat trick, yay.
Yes, and more in the works every single day.
A lot in the works. A lot in the works every day, Mr. Kimball. It becomes one blur, which I can still pick out the specific colors of. Yes.
You tackled those stairs today. I saw that.
I did. I only did 3,000. I had a pretty good streak going of 5,000 every day, but you have to be realistic, don't you, Kimball? You can't be out there just pushing it that hard every single day because that will take its toll. So as long as you're out there, I guess, most days, kept my streak going. But yes, the stairs. People might think that the stairs is fun and all of that, but it really sucks. It's not a good time at all. There's no enjoyment to be had in running the stairs. It's not in any way like, ooh, this is a positive experience I'm having. After I'm done, sure, but you really have to force yourself to go. It's kind of mundane, even though I do write in my head the entire time going up and down. But you know what, Kimball? I'm doing that anyway, so I'm just doing it on stairs.
Another streak as well. What is it now, some 5.5 years without a drink?
I think I might be off by like a week or two, but I do this thing on the blog, and I'm sure like if someone was really a stickler, they could go in there and find that I am off like a week or two, or I might be dead on, but I know I start on a Sunday, so what I do is close to every Sunday, it might be a few days after, I put up the day count, and then I divide by 7 and get the week count, and I think I'm up to 294 weeks, and really it was only the... yesterday, it was a bad weekend, which he's saying says quite a lot here. I had a day of weakening where I thought, it wasn't like I was close, but I thought like, oh, I could give in today. But I also know if I give in at this point, I won't come back out again. But yeah, I try to just keep these. There's a lot of numbers in my life, I've realized. And I'm not like really like a necessarily a numbers guy. Like I wasn't like Captain Math or anything like that. But the numbers in my life, like the days, the thousands of days of the non-drinking and the thousands of stairs each day and the word count and trying to finish a story today that ended up being 6,100 words. I just deal. It's like, it's not baseball reference, ColinReference.com. Lots of numbers.
Let's talk about some films here to begin our discussion this afternoon. And first of all, an early film, a short film from Jean-Luc Godard, 1957, All the Boys Are Called Patrick. Very interesting little film.
Aren't they all called Patrick, right? The catch-all for how dirty and handsy boys are and what they're up to and what they want from the young fillies. But it's quite a clever film. So it's, like you said, it's 1957. So in the Godard chronology, that's going to be 3 years before Breathless. Sort of like there's before Breathless and there's after Breathless. But there's a few things in common, I think, with this film. One of the things I like about Godard is you never really know what's going to happen. It's not like it's just going to be like random things dropped in there. Like sometimes Bunuel would just be like, I shall drop this random thing in that has nothing to do with anything and haven't I surprised you with how absurd I am. And that's not what Godard does, but he comes at you cinematically the way life can come at you in its way. And so this short film, it's about 20 minutes long, is about a guy named Patrick, of course, and he is trying to pick up this smoking hot college girl. And he's using all of his lines, and she knows his lines, but at the same time, she's as if she's saying, I don't like your lines, but I kind of do. Keep trying them. It'll work eventually. And so he does, and they go to a cafe and all this stuff, and he thinks it's gone pretty well for himself. So like a little bit later, like immediately after, he sees this other smoking hot girl, young woman. And he does it all over again. And like it also goes like fairly well. Well, cut to this indoor scene. We've been outside and we're going inside. And the two girls are roommates. And they're kind of like the their roommates that you get like a little bit of a sense that there's been some exploration there. So they're just barely on the right side, maybe the wrong side, depending on your point of view, of breaking out into a pillow fight because they're like chastising each other, ribbing each other and all that stuff. And they are each talking about this guy they met. It's a bit Three's Company that way, but it's more artful than Three's Company. Like, Larry doesn't pop in. He's like, hey, girls. So they're sort of trying to one-up each other with this, well, not conquest, but like conquest to be, maybe. And then they're out back again. So it's like in three parts, really, the short sort of coda part. And they see the kid. They see the guy. And he realizes that the jig is up. And he just departs the scene, like gets into a cab. He's like, I'm out. And then it's the end. But it's very true to life. I mean, it's sort of like an absurd situation, but there's a reason that the word exists, because the situations exist, and Godard taps into that.
Any similarities between the Patrick character and what we would see developed more in Jean-Paul Belmondo's character in Breathless?
I think this is frothier. It's lighter. And there's a spiritedness, I'd say, to Breathless that's more mature, that isn't here. This is an aperitif, really. This is just like before you get to the main course. But it does it a disservice, I think, to just say it's a work of like juvenilia for Godard, because it isn't. It's really a well-made, well-formed, fully formed, is what I mean by that, short film. And again, I like that idea of you don't know what's going to happen. I mean, think of like when you're reading a novel, and almost anyone who's ever written, you expect something to change and to come, but you expect that change to come from a certain like direction, like a certain like angle on the compass. And someone like Tolstoy, I think this is, someone had said, you and Tolstoy are the only two people I've seen who do this. The change comes, but it never comes from the direction that like you're kind of looking for it to come.
Mm.
And so I think Godard does like a movie version of that. He's someone like, it's almost like when you talk about the 1986 Red Sox in Game 6, and you think each time you watch it, or at least I do, that you're going to see a different outcome. It's going to work out fine, because it certainly won't go the way that you actually know it does go. I have that feeling even when I've seen the Godard film lots of times, and I'm watching it, thinking, you never know. Choose your own adventure. Might proceed differently this time. So I think he had that pretty early on here, 3 years before Breathless.
We're talking with Colin Fleming on Downtown. Well, the next film won't be confused by anybody as an art film, but I had not seen this in, I would say, more than 20 years. And what a treat it was to go back and revisit one of the classic films in the So Bad They're Good category. 1964 is The Horror of Party Beach.
Which begs the question, what caused you to watch this in 2002?
I was trying to remember. It either came on a VCR collection, VHS collection of really bad 60s horror films, or it might have been on a late night cable like the old TV 38 or something like that. And I remember the first time watching it, just being blown away at how awesomely bad it was. And well, it's aged quite well, thank you. Del Tenney had something good going on with this classic.
Yes, and I like that he was kind of the Ed Wood of Stamford, Connecticut.
Yes.
Like, so it's like it's Fairfield County, but it's like the scuzzier part of Fairfield County. It's not the Greenwich part of Fairfield County. Like, I didn't even know until a few years ago that Stamford was technically part of Fairfield County. So he was the Ed Wood of the area. And speaking about Godard and spiritedness, this has spirit. You have to say that, like, there are some films that are so bad you can't watch them, but this is pretty watchable. Plan 9 from Outer Space is pretty watchable.
Oh, yeah.
You can get through it. It's not like, I mean, the production values and the plot loopholes and dialogue and the scenarios, same damn band at the same beach party all the time. And it, like, I just like the beginning. It's like the movie shows up. Sometimes movies at the beginning, even when they're awful, they sort of go through the motions of not being awful for like, I don't know, a scene or two. This movie pulls up like with a boat, and they dump like this big like like vat into the oceans. Like it's labeled, it's like telegraphs the entire movie, like danger, radioactive.
And they're like, they're what about
right away and says
they're about 20 yards offshore when they do this.
Yeah, during the day. And yeah. I just like that the movie that has the chutzpah to say, hey, what's up? We're here. Gonna suck. Buckle up. They don't even like give you like half a scene of like, or like a title sequence or something like that. They just come out and like flash you with their badness. And then they don't put the rope back on for the entire thing. So there's this really annoying woman. And she's dating like this scientist guy who has this mentor. And they're partying on the beach, and she's drunk, and you just want to see her dispatched pretty quickly. And there's this, like, these two guys are fighting over her. But then they both hate her so much that they kind of bond. She goes off. There's this, it's not a very good costume. That's really a nice way for me to put it.
Yes.
Of this, I don't know, like this microwave creature from the Black Lagoon with these sausages hanging out of its mouth for some reason. And it's going to take care of her. And you always have the same band rocking out on the beach. And the young scientist guy, he meets this like this other woman, and she's an adult, but she has a sleepover scheduled later. So talk about like your sapphic leaning, but she has a bad feeling, and she's not going to go. And I love the solution they come up with, because not only is there this one like microwave creature from the Black Lagoon, they get a bunch of these other ones, and they're all in cahoots with each other. And the senior scientist guy goes, "Eureka! I have it! We'll just kill him with salt. He'll be fine."
I also, Del Tenney knew who was going to the drive-in to watch the horror of Party Beach, because there are, for 1964, a whole lot of close-up shots of bikini bottoms.
He gives you gore. He gives you the bikini bottoms. And he helps you out. This could have been his slogan. I help you out as you hook up. Because when you go to the drive-in, you could do some of that necking for a while. You could do it for 17 minutes and just come back. And you wouldn't miss a beat in this movie. Yeah, but it's the same thing over and over again. And it's not like, oh, honey, can you rewind that? Some like crucial plot detail has like passed your attention. No, it's, but I like it. I like it because it's spirited. And I'll give you an example of what I mean by that. And you see these, I love that all of these literary magazines are folding because they just publish garbage. No one wants any of it. And now COVID is killing them off. And CNN even had this article of all places about it recently. And you look at that stilted formulaic prose. I see this thing like each year, I don't know what it's for exactly, where it's like kids are sort of made fun of for things that they've written. By kids, I mean like middle school students, high school students, that kind of thing. And you see like their bad similes and all that kind of stuff. And a lot of it is just like violations of grammar. But I'd rather read what those kids write, because they're seeing the world with spiritedness.
Yes.
And they're expressing themselves with spiritedness. And there's more life in that. Now, it's not like well-honed or anything, but it makes for better reading than, not like you'd actually formally read it, but you know what I mean. You can get through a film like this. I'd rather watch this than freaking Licorice Pizza or something that tries to be so arty and pretentious and, oh, yes, like those two guys in the Muppet Show might dig it, but at least this has a certain winsome genuineness to it, as much as it does suck.
All right, from there to the world of music and Beethoven Goes Irish. Tell me about this collection.
So, our man Beethoven, and people think of him as serious and severe. And if you're one of those people, you shouldn't think of him that way, because Beethoven, well, not in his personal life, he was just a miserable grump. But in his music, there is everything. There's everything human. And so you can listen to Beethoven piano sonatas that are humorous even. They'll make you laugh. And he scored. He was given these pieces of Irish music. So it's like folk music. Slumming it, I guess, as people would think of Beethoven, with what they expect of Beethoven. And he was to orchestrate this music. He was to make these arrangements, and the guy who'd given him the airs was then going to go out and find people to put words to them. And it's this really cool, like, Beethoven side project which was just part of his overall corpus, his output. And all of the artists that I care about the most, they all have this, well, they have certain things in common. They have that spiritedness. Their work is imbued with life. And they have range. And when they have the range, they can be doing such distinctive works from their other works. But there are certain things that allow us right away to identify it as them. And the number of artists I can put in this group might be like 12 that have ever existed. So this is something that I've always thought well of with Beethoven, because it's like Beethoven meets the Pogues. And that's just a delicious notion, I think. So these are good ways, if you're like, oh, I'm intimidated by those symphonies or those late string quartets or the piano sonatas, like the big voice stuff, to sort of enter into the world of Beethoven with some tunes. I mean, these are tunes.
Oh, yes. And
you can listen to these like when you're on the Precor or whatever the machines that I don't use are called, because I'm on stairs. So I think that's surprising to a lot of people.
And finally, a wonderful piece in the Smart Set, available at thesmartset.com, that you wrote on the Beatles, called Loving You More, Romancing and Being Romanced by the Beatles. And this is such a great piece, Colin, on a whole lot of levels, starting with your story of moving out to Chicago and finding a music fan's nirvana.
Yeah, it definitely was for me. So we moved from Connecticut, where we were just for a few years. And that's when I had started like really getting into Beatles and bootlegs and stuff like that, to Chicago. So it was halfway through high school for me. It was quite a difficult move. And I could drive by then. Like, I was like a year into driving. And I had gone out there before we moved, like with my dad, and he worked in the city. And there was like a row of record stores. They were like clustered together. I sort of hope they're still there, these used record stores, these with the CD racks and everything. And you could get these bootlegs. I mean, this was, even now, I'm just like getting all excited about this, because this was like the treasure of treasure. This was mind blowing to me. Like, really, it was like peeling back like a little corner of utopia, and like the Xanadu, the Shangri-La rather, and like the mountains, like you can go in. And so my father, like, he's like, okay, follow this road, and this road. And it was like the only thing I could drive. It's like the big city. I was scared. So I'd go in and I'd get these recordings. And so the piece sort of talks about how I wanted to get the complete Ed Sullivan Show performances, in part, because of this moment when, after Paul McCartney sings Yesterday in August of 1965, John Lennon makes this singular comment, a strange kind of comment, a fitting comment, though, where he says, thank you, Paul, that was just like him. It's like he's addressing the audience, and he's having this very sort of open, naked moment with his friend, too. Like, you almost got the sense that this wasn't something he said to him in private. He had to say it there. And so the piece then becomes about what it would have been like to have been a Beatles fan in 1977, which was a big time, because if you hadn't seen the Beatles on Ed Sullivan or gone to one of their shows, you probably never would have had heard them live previously. So that year you got Live at the Hollywood Bowl, which was a big thing. And you got this double disc compilation of called Love Songs. And so on Love Songs, separated by one track, Love Songs is this hodgepodge. It's a very strange album where it's like there'll be a song from the White Album next to a song from Please Please Me. That's how it wraps up, actually. And so I looked at these two songs, one by Lennon, one by McCartney, that I consider the Beatles' two best actual love songs, and how they arrive at separate places that's very true to the talent of each of them, but through means that are quite similar and which we wouldn't expect.
And the two songs are Lennon's In My Life and McCartney's Here, There, and Everywhere.
In My Life is this song where Lennon, as he's writing it, he's going large. And something that I realized a while ago, 2 years ago now, that when I did my small was so much bigger than anyone else's large, that I didn't have to try to go big. Because what I did when I stayed within myself was going to be just more than anyone else's more. I don't mean like maximalist regard. I mean, in terms of impact, in terms of the totality of the work. It's like in ball four, Jim Bowden was, before he blew his arm out, he comes up to the major leagues and he's throwing within a foot of where he wants the ball. And he thought he had poor control. And someone said to him, like, no, but it's great control. It's like he didn't realize that that's what that entailed. So Lennon starts like listing all these places in Liverpool, in this song, In My Life. And so it's sort of like this proto Strawberry Fields, and in a way, Penny Lane, those songs from a couple of years later, which are going to be about childhood in one sense. And he has this big word soupy salad type of song, like And I Am the Walrus during 1965. And then he just starts paring back. He starts, because he realizes, and I think every great artist eventually does, that your less will beat anyone else's more. And so he gets to that point. Whereas McCartney, with Here, There, and Everywhere, he was at the point from the jump. He always understood that his less was going to be more. So he takes this song that's comprised of so few words, so few notes in some ways, repetition of words. He really builds this giant emotional musical piece out of not a lot. So there you have that whole, like, his less is going to be more than anyone else's more.
And you point out, too, that there was a turning point in terms of the, I guess we'd say, the heavy lifting when it came to songwriting, that the early years of the Beatles were characterized by a heavy emphasis on Lennon songs. And then, obviously, McCartney took on a much greater role, what, post-Rubber Soul?
Yes, yes, that's the changing point, the baton passing from Rubber Soul to Revolver. And we have spoken about recency bias. And how, I think it was last week, people, it's almost like they talk about, well, the NBA, the 75 best players of all time. And I see all these people talking about people who weren't listed on the team, who didn't make the list, rather. They're all people from their life, Tracy McGrady, whoever it is, right? No one's saying Tommy Heinsohn, who really probably is a better case than, like, I don't know, Bill Walton, maybe, or even Robert Parrish, one of my favorites. There's a sort of recency bias, strange as it sounds, with the Beatles. There's such an emphasis on the music from Sgt. Pepper on. I think that's because that's what gets played on classic rock radio, or it was. And that's what people like. No, that's like the hipper stuff. To me, there's no more infectious music in all of music than the early Beatles. I would take the early Beatles over any other part of the Beatles every single day. And the leader of the band at the time, John Lennon, was dominating those early albums. He dominates up through Rubber Soul. And after that, it's like Lennon can't be arsed, and McCartney steps up. So it's just interesting, too, that the best album of John Lennon's writing life is Rubber Soul. And then the best album of Paul McCartney's writing life is Revolver. Like, it's that clear. There's not really any argument to be made there. After that, they're going to hodgepodge a lot of things. There's a lot of hodgepodge on Pepper, certainly the White Album, even though they're like treating each other as like the other members as a backing band. Abbey Road is almost all hodgepodge, to the point that they're like, I have a scrap of this. Oh, I have a scrap of this. Let's stick it together, because they're near the end as writers within that particular crucible. But they weren't at Rubber Soul and Revolver. And so you have Lennon songs with Revolver. You have McCartney songs with Rubber Soul, and then McCartney with Revolver. But this sort of parallel notion between these two love songs, where we really see the differences between the two men. They get to a same efficacious point, and they use similar techniques, but they don't come to those techniques the same way.
And interesting, too, either genius or just dumb luck, but whoever sequenced the love songs collection, putting Buddy Holly between those two songs, knowing what a huge influence his work was to both John and Paul.
Right, and I talked about that's Words of Love that is there, and I talked about how it's almost like this matchmaker song. It's like, oh, hey, I have this client I think you might like, and like playing that go-between matchmaker role. And so that's fitting. Now, I'm sure they didn't have that in mind with the design. Like, it's a lot of luck, because there's so much, like, the multiple disc set ends with, like, I Will, and then they go out the last song, which we talked about recently, is P.S. I Love You, and it's fine, but it's not like this masterwork of a love song. And I think that's something, too, that was important to the Beatles. It's like you have Ella Fitzgerald, and she sings the Great American Songbook. And there were all those different albums she did by all those like amazing Tin Pan Alley type of writers, the songsmiths. The Beatles were consciously trying to write themselves, if not into that tradition, to that level. And the way you did that, and you think about the songs that endure, a lot of times they're love songs. Why? Well, that's kind of a concern for all of us, whether we have it, we don't have it, or we want it. Same reason Madame Bovary endures, or it should, or I hope it continues to. The novel is love song, and all of that the torturous side stuff that can go along with it, too. So I don't think we have love songs anymore. I'd argue that something like Creep is a beautiful love song, but that's from 1993 at this point. So that's well in the past. But these guys were trying to write love songs because that was the serious stuff. That was like what got you like the Stanley Cup of songwriting. So it's weird that P.S. I Love You is last, but it's fitting that these two songs are right there. One's on one side of the block, the other's on the other side of the block. They're going out for coffee, and it might go smashingly.
And you mentioned 77. That's interesting because I was, 18, 19 when those albums came out, and I followed the Beatles, but I was not a big Beatles fan. I was a little young for them when they first burst on the scene. It wasn't until later. And so for me, I was more excited about the Love Songs collection because it exposed me to some of those album tracks that I didn't know as well. I think the hardcore Beatles fans at that point, who had been around since the beginning, were far more excited at the time for the Hollywood Bowl release.
Well, the really shrewd ones would have been pumped even more because of the piecemeal, dodgy, but available, live at the Star Club that came out. And it was like of questionable legality, but you could get it at the record store. It wasn't the full what we have now. But that would have been, I was like 1.5. But if I was older, that would have been to me like, are you kidding me? Like, we can listen like that. I wouldn't have believed someone that existed. I would have thought, this is a fake. I need to listen to this. It's probably just some guys like in a garage pretending they're the Beatles, like with a tape recorder, like really far away, so it sounds authentic. But that was just this strange kind of renaissance year where someone at Capitol is like, Beatles time. And when you think about it, it really is remarkable that if you didn't see Ed Sullivan, and it's not like you would have had the DVD. You could just go pop it in whenever you want. And you hadn't been at some show in Indianapolis in the mid-60s. Like, you really could never have heard what they sounded like live.
Right.
I mean, that's just sort of like mind-blowing to me. Because when I got into it and I came along, and I started with compilations too. I started with like the greatest hits and the red and the
blue and the red. Yeah, me too.
And Rock and Roll was from 76, so like this actually started a little bit earlier, this whole like sort of renaissance idea, like let's like remarket these guys. And it was a strange time because you had soft rock and you had disco and you had like the Ramones, and someone's like, we should do, like the Beatles would have been classing up the joint. They would have been that sort of musical listening generation, like Irving Berlin. That's what that was. I think it was an attempt to be like, look, these dudes are classy. These are the Gershwins. Take this seriously, people. I think that's what the Love Songs compilation was. And then they didn't even like bother to really think through the sequencing at all.
Check out Colin's piece at thesmartset.com. And again, grab one of his three recent books, Sam Cooke, Live at the Harlem Square Club, 1963, Scrooge, and If You, brackets, Fabula, Fantasy, Effery, Hope, all available wherever fine books are sold. Colin, we thank you. We'll do it again next week.
Okay, sounds good.